and Rowena's smooth voice answered, "Hello, Kate. How is Cotlin?" Telling her that one of her journeymen just called me Lady Ma'am would be counterproductive. "He's fine. When will you bring him by?" Rowena came from the same village as my mother. They shared a similar magical talent, although my mother's had been much stronger. The talent came with a price. Women who possessed it had a hard time getting pregnant, and an even harder time carrying a child to term. I was an exception. Perhaps it had to do with Roland's genes, but Curran and I had had no trouble conceiving. Rowena never had children of her own, but she desperately wanted some. She once told me that while my father was alive, the world wasn't safe enough for her children. Instead, she lavished all of her maternal affection on my son. "As soon as I can. I have some bad news."
"Is it your father?"
A hint of alarm undercut her words. "No. At least, I don't think so," I explained Serenby.
"That's horrible,"
Rowena finally said. Not much shocked a master of the dead. Not much shocked me, either. By now I'd told this story about 7 or 8 times. You'd think repetition would file the sharp edge off it. But no. Every time was as disturbing as the last.
"We'll call down to Biohazard and try to get some samples for analysis," Rowena said.
"That would be amazing." I said goodbye and hung up before she had a chance to ask me if Conlon had developed any magical powers. Everybody wanted my son to be something more. He was perfect the way he was. Someone rapped their knuckles on my door. "Come in," I called. The door swung open, and Raphael walked in, carrying a dark green bottle. He wore a dark gray suit. "Beware the Bowdas," I said, "especially when they bear gifts." He smiled.
"Can I come in?"
"Please," I pointed to my client chair. "Sit down." He did. His black hair fell on his shoulders in a soft wave. Usually, when people used words like smoldering to describe a man, I just laughed. However, for Raphael, that word felt entirely appropriate. There was something about him, something in his dark blue eyes, in the way he carried himself with a hint of feral shapeshifter cutting through the polish, that made women think of sex. Luckily, I was immune. "What's in the bottle?" He pushed it across the desk to me. The handwritten label with a cute orange-yellow apple read, "Bee's Best Cider." I whistled. Now I know it's bad. When Curran and I got married, Clan Bear provided several barrels of honey ale for the wedding. The ale was a roaring success. Raphael realized that the Bowda clan house sat in the middle of an apple orchard and sensed a business opportunity. Bee's Cider hit the market a year ago, and like all things Raphael touched, it turned to gold. He leaned back in the chair, one long leg over another. Life with Andrea was good to Raphael. He looked clean cut. His suit fit him so well it had to be tailored. "Let me guess, your tailor is holding your latest outfit hostage and you want me to liberate it?"
"If I asked you to do that, everything would be covered in blood and my suit would be ruined. No, I'd ask my wife. She'd shoot him between the eyes from 100 yards away."
"That she would."
"I came to talk about the boy," he said. "I brought the cider because it isn't an easy conversation."
"Oh."
"I've come to ask you to let him go."
"I thought as much." "Why isn't Ascanio here to speak for himself?"
"Because you took him in when nobody would have him. Aunt B sent him to you because he was impossible to handle, and she knew that sooner or later he would do the wrong thing or say the wrong thing, and someone would rip out his throat. You gave him a job, a place he belonged. You trained him, and you trusted him. You turned him into someone who is now an asset to the clan. He understands all of this. He's loyal to you."
He paused. I waited for him to continue.
"But he also wants things."
"What things?"
"We can start with money. He can earn money here, but he wants more. He wants wealth.
He and I both knew that Escania wouldn't get wealth working for me. Cutting Edge paid the bills, but it wouldn't make anyone rich. I had no interest in expanding. I liked that we were small.
Also, he wants acceptance, responsibility, and power. He wants to climb the clan's power hierarchy. At his core, he's a Bowda, and he needs other Bowdas to acknowledge how good he is.
Okay.
Both of these are means to an end.
Raphael leaned forward.
What he really wants is
security, I told him. I taught him for almost 4 years, Raphael. He grew up without a male role model in a hellish place, so when he went to the clan, he fixated on you. He wants to be you, a respected, successful, dangerous alpha. I figured all this out a long time ago.
He's been working for me for the last 6 months,
Raphael said. Uh-huh. Raphael chewed on his lip.
There is no point in trying to be diplomatic, so I'm just going to come out and say it. Male 19-year-old Bowders think with their balls. Andrea and I spend half of our time fighting to keep them out of Jim's rock-hauling camp.
Like Curran, Jim constantly improved the keep, adding on towers, walls, and escape tunnels. A good portion of those improvements were built by Bowdas between ages 12 and 25, performing the Pact's version of community service for various infractions. The Bowdas couldn't seem to stay out of trouble, and Jim always welcomed free labor.
Escanio is different from his peers,
Raphael said.
He thinks with his head, and he's strategic in his decisions. When we sent him down to Kentucky, he ran into...
Raphael paused.
Into trouble. He handled it better than I did.
I have no doubt he did.
We need him, and he needs us. And I realize that my mother dumped him on you, and you spent 4 years stabilizing, teaching, and hammering him into what he is today. And now that he's useful, we want him back, and it's unfair. I'm sorry. I owe you. Our entire clan owes you.
You don't owe me anything. I did it for him, not for you.
But you did it, and someone has to appreciate it. I'm here to say that we acknowledge it, and we won't forget. If you leave it up to him, he will never walk away from you. He can't. His sense of loyalty won't let him. But he won't be happy here. He wants recognition and acceptance from the Pack. Like it or not, you're not just anyone, Kate. You are the Inshinar. The longer you keep him with you, the harder it will be for him to be seen as separate from you.
He just had to throw it in my face. I sighed. Do you see any chains around here, Raphael?
No.
His smile was sad. Okay, then. He isn't an indentured servant. He's free to do as he wants. I'll take him off the payroll as of today. He is welcome to come back any time, but I will stop calling.
Thank you,
he said. It's not about you. He should do whatever makes him happy. Raphael nodded again. He looked miserable. I let him off the hook. How is Baby B doing? He grinned.
A wolf boy tried to steal her toy at the picnic last week. She chased him down, took the toy away, and beat him bloody with it.
You must be so proud.
Oh, I am.
I'll see you around, Raphael.
You will, Kate.
He left. Well, that was that. I felt oddly hollow. No more funny one-liners. No more tortured Latin, no more off-color jokes. It had been moving to this moment for a while, but it still made me feel empty. Derek walked into the office.
What did Raphael want?
I shook my head. Nothing important. Derek eyed the bottle of cider and pulled two small paper bags out of a larger paper bag. The delicious aroma of Mexican spices filled the air. chicken soft tacos. My favorite. The closest Mexican place was about 2 miles off. He'd gone to get them for me. I got up, got 2 glasses, opened the cider, and poured some for us. He landed in the client chair and bit into his taco. I chewed mine. Delicious.
I'm going back to Serenby tomorrow, he said. I want to do a wider search, see if I can pick up a trail.
Okay, I said. We chewed some more. Do you ever want wealth? I asked. Derek paused his chewing.
No.
I mean, do you ever want more money? He gave me a one-shouldered shrug.
My bills are paid. Got enough for food. Got enough for tools of the trade. Can buy Christmas presents. What else would I need?
I nodded. We drank our cider and ate our tacos, and it was nice. Chapter 3 Two big gray eyes regarded me from a round face, lit up by the morning light filtering through the kitchen window. Conlon pushed the oatmeal away.
No!
Yes.
Honey!
I crossed my arms. Did Grandma give you honey muffins yesterday? His eyes lit up.
Grandma!
Grandma isn't here. My son made nom-nom noises. When I was pregnant, I tried to avoid doing dangerous things, which left me with a lot of time on my hands. I'd spent it reading baby books. Those books made it crystal clear that giving honey to your baby before he was a year old made you a terrible mother. The moment a spoon of honey would touch his lips, the words, awful mother, would appear on your forehead, forever branding you as a parenting failure. I had explained this to Mahan and Martha. They listened, nodded, and agreed, and then proceeded to ignore me. They'd been giving him honey and various honey-infused sweets since he was able to hold them in his tiny hands, and then lied to my face about it. Werebear parents-in-law came with their own challenges. You're not getting honey. You will eat oatmeal.
No.
He pushed the cereal away. Okay, then you'll go hungry.
Honey!
In baby terms, my son was developing at the speed of light. At 13 months, most babies had a vocabulary of 3 or 4 words. Mama, dada, bye-bye, uh-oh. The experts called this phase passive language acquisition. My sweet dumpling was making tiny sentences and arguing with me about honey. At this point, I wasn't sure if I was proud or frustrated. Probably both. I have to do a lot of work today, I told him, and neither your grandparents nor your aunt can watch you because they have clan business. So you're stuck with me.
Honey!
Conlon sniffled. I don't negotiate with terrorists. Oatmeal or nothing. I put some oatmeal into my own bowl from the pot, added salt and butter, and spooned into my mouth. I'm going to eat all this and be nice and full. Conlon watched the spoon travel to my mouth. 1, 2, 3. He pulled the bowl to him and dug in with his spoon. Hunger won again. My son wasn't a shapeshifter, but he certainly ate like one. I licked my spoon. Today was going to be a busy day. The phone rang. I picked it up. Hello?
Hey, Kate, Luther said.
He didn't call me a heathen or a troglodyte. Things were bad. How did it go?
You were right. They extracted the bones.
My mind took a moment to digest it. What kept the bugs away?
We don't know yet. The substance is magically inert, but not devoid of magic. It registers blue on the M-scan, but I can't tell you if it's due to human remains or the nature of the solution itself. Is your sensate around?
No. Julie was still off with Curran. I wish they were home.
A pity.
Did you find any inhuman blood in any of the houses?
We found hair, Luther said. Coarse, reddish-brown. Short. In one of the houses, someone tore a chunk of it out of their attacker.
DNA?
We are running it now.
Is it hair or fur?
Good question. It has an amorphous medulla, consistent with human hair, and a coronal cuticle, which can occasionally be found in humans, but typically indicates a rodent, a bat, for example. Human head hair continues to grow until we cut it. This hair exhibits synchronized growth, meaning at some point it stopped growing, like fur. It wasn't cut. But it also exhibits a club root, which is typical to humans. It is inconsistent with shapeshifter hair in some respects and consistent in others.
Are you trying to tell me this is a human-bat hybrid?
Don't be ridiculous. Frustration spiked his voice. I'm trying to tell you that I spent 24 hours digging in a jellied mass grave and then analyzing what I found, and I have nothing to show for it.
That's not true. You have a sample for comparison.
I'll let you know if I find anything else.
Thanks.
And Kate, if you run across this again, I want to know about it the moment it happens.
That might be a little difficult, Luther. Last I checked, telepathy wasn't among my talents. He hung up. Someone's pissy, I told Conlon. Conlon didn't look impressed. I dialed Nick's direct number. Usually I went through the proper channels, meaning Maxine, but he hadn't called me back, and Biohazard wouldn't notify them. The order's legal status as a law enforcement agency had always been murky. However, after the Wilmington massacre, the Knights were firmly outside the law. Some kids at UNC in Wilmington took a fun new drug that turned them into monsters. It also robbed them of their intelligence, because their monstrous rampage consisted of running around their dorm and growling at passersby. The order was called in, and instead of securing the scene and waiting, the Knights made an executive decision to go in and slaughter everyone they found. Midway through the slaughter, the magic wave ended, and the kids turned back into humans. The order didn't stop. When the blood stopped spraying, 12 young people were dead. At the trial, the Knight Protector of the Wilmington chapter testified that he didn't care if they returned to human form or not. In his opinion, they stopped being human when they took the drug. The national fallout was catastrophic. Some states still recognized the order's semi-law enforcement position, but Georgia wasn't one of them. All cooperation between law enforcement agencies and the order had ceased as of last year. I didn't care for the order's methods, or for Nick calling me and my baby abominations every chance he got. But the order had accumulated decades worth of magic knowledge. If my going to Nick would help prevent another Serenbe, it would be worth it. The message I'd left yesterday was short. It had only two words, call me. He knew I wouldn't come to him unless it was an emergency. Since he hadn't called me back, I felt the need to make this one slightly longer. That done, I sat Conlon down and got his fire truck out of storage. The truck was a gift from Jim and Dolly for his first birthday. Large enough for a small child to sit in and climb on, it had a tiny enchanted water engine, which powered lights and a ladder during magic waves. It must have cost them an arm and a leg. Conlon adored the truck. He showed no interest in riding in it, but he liked to climb on the roof, which usually took him a solid minute and multiple tries. Once he ascended, he would wave his arms and make strange noises. Sometimes he fell asleep on top of it. Like his dad, my son enjoyed being in high places. Conlon began his epic journey, and I pulled files on mass disappearances, landed on the floor close enough to catch him if he decided to swan dive, and tried to review what little was known about people vanishing. Of all the recorded mass disappearances, the Roanoke colony was the most famous, but there were others. Easter Island, whose inhabitants had melted into thin air, leaving behind only statues. Ancient Puebloans, who were once called Anasazi, meaning ancient enemies. The village of Hoare Verde in Brazil. That one was especially creepy. The theories said that the Easter Islanders might have starved to death, and Roanoke's colonists might have died of plague, but everyone was pretty sure something really bad had happened at Hoare Verde. 600 Brazilians vanished without a trace in 1923, leaving behind a gun that had been fired and a note that read, "There is no salvation." All those were pre-shift. Post-shift, disappearances increased in frequency, but were usually, eventually, solved. Typically, something had eaten the people or some magic disease had nuked everyone and burned itself out. One case listed mysterious blue lights floating in the air, which caused the population of a small town to strip naked and run off into the woods after them. They were eventually found by local sheriffs, confused and embarrassed. The worst injuries suffered amounted to scratches and severe cases of poison ivy exposure. There was nothing in any of the files about boiled people or jellied mass graves. The phone rang. I grabbed it, watching Conlon trying to scoot backward on the truck's roof.
"Hello, Kate,"
Maxine said.
That ass. Couldn't call himself, made his secretary do it. That was a new low, even for Nick.
"Hi, Maxine. How is my nemesis?"
"We need your help."
"I'm sorry, what?"
"We need your help," she repeated.
Conlon got to his feet and made a tiny hop on top of the truck, achieving a lift of about an inch. I walked closer to the truck. "What can I do for you?"
"We've received a group from Wolf Trap."
Wolf Trap, Virginia, housed the Order's national headquarters.
"I believe they are here to remove Nicholas Feldman from his position as Night Protector."
"What?"
Nick was the first decent Night Protector that office had had in the last 10 years. His predecessor managed to get the entire chapter killed.
"Why?"
"Nicholas has been rather vocal in his criticism of the Order. It has caused problems."
There was an awful vulnerable edge to Maxine's voice. In my time with the Order, she'd been unflappable. No matter what happened, Maxine handled it with her trademark efficiency. "Within the chapter?"
"No. The knights of the chapter are devoted to him. In the past, we have become a refuge for—
"Problem cases," I finished for her. Atlanta always was the dumping ground for troublesome knights.
"Yes. Nicholas has a unique talent when it comes to helping people find their niche. He makes sure that they become useful. Most of them owe their lives to him in more than one way."
The Order encouraged loyalty to the local Night Protectors, and the Atlanta chapter was no exception. In the few times I'd seen Nick interact with his knights, the relationships seemed to be based on mutual respect. They did what he told them to do, and they didn't question him in my presence. The Order would have to have a reason for removing him, I thought out loud. One can't just pull a Night Protector out of his chapter. Is performance down?
No. Our ratio of completed petitions is at an all-time high.
Then what's the problem?
He has been direct in expressing his frustration with their non-involvement in the claiming of Atlanta and the general situation with your father.
Oh, great. I could imagine the reports filed with Wolf Trap. Are you aware that an abomination named Kate Leonard has claimed the city of Atlanta? Why are you not doing anything about the claiming of Atlanta? Are you planning on doing something about this matter in the near future? Could we have a time frame in which this issue might be resolved? When something got under his skin, Nick was unshut-upable, and the Order at large desperately wanted to ignore my existence. They didn't have the power to do anything about me. I was pretty sure they hoped I would just somehow go away, and here was Nick, shining a big searchlight on the problem they were pretending to not see.
"They don't believe he possesses the diplomatic flexibility necessary for the post,"
Maxine said. "How do you know that?"
"I scanned their minds."
Whoa. For Maxine, that was a massive breach of ethics.
"I had no choice," Maxine said quietly. "I've given 25 years to the Order. I've felt an entire chapter die one by one. I can't do this again." She sounded at the end of her rope.
Let me guess. They're going to remove him because he isn't diplomatic enough to work with me?
Yes.
Anxiety vibrated in Maxine's voice.
He was invited to a lunch. He went armed. Before he left, he had a particular mindset. You must understand, this chapter is all he has.
Oh, I understood perfectly. Nick would go down swinging. They didn't summon him to Wolf Trap because he wouldn't go, and they didn't want to do this within the chapter walls, in front of the other knights, where he was at his strongest.
You must understand, when I said that the knights are devoted to him, I meant that they are deeply committed to his goals.
If Nick went down, the chapter would revolt. They'd picked a hell of a time for this. Conlon balanced on the edge of the truck.
If I didn't handle this right now, the chapter would collapse on itself. Nick would likely die, and that was the last thing I wanted.
Where is this lunch?
At the Amber Badger.
It would take me 20 minutes. It would take him at least 30 to get there from the chapter. These knights from Wolf Trap really wanted to put some distance between him and his people.
When did he leave? About 5 minutes ago.
I'm on it. Keep everyone calm, please. I hung up and lunged forward just as Conlon jumped off the truck. He landed in my arms and giggled. My son, the daredevil. It's good that I have a short reaction time. I hugged him and smooched his forehead. Let's go get dressed. We've got to save Uncle Nick Stupidhead from himself. I walked into the Amber Badger, carrying Conlon. He hadn't wanted to put on clothes. I'd successfully wrestled him into a t-shirt and a pair of shorts, but it took me 10 minutes longer than planned to get to the restaurant. Here's hoping I wasn't too late. The hostess smiled at me.
Can I help you?
I'm looking for a party of the Order's knights, armed, scary, probably scowling.
This way.
The inside of the Amber Badger resembled a medieval tavern, with stone walls, scrubbed wooden floors, pendants on the walls, and sturdy wooden tables. It was half empty, and I had no trouble spotting Nick and three knights at a table near the far wall. Nick's face had that detached, cold look he got just before his sword came out of its sheath. The other three, two men, one dark-skinned in his 40s, one white and slightly younger, and a Hispanic woman, about my age, held themselves with the ease of seasoned fighters. Not relaxed, but not tense either. A half-full platter of pretzels with cheese and beer sauce rested on the table. Oh, good. They were still on appetizers. They wouldn't fire him until the main course. I marched straight to the table. Nick raised his head and saw me. His eyes widened. I came to a stop by the table. Knight Protector?
Yes. The three other knights stared at me.
Can I steal a moment of your time?
Nick appeared to waver.
Say yes. Say yes, you moron. I'm trying to demonstrate rapport here.
Sure, he said.
Oh, good. Let me grab a chair. I handed Conlon to Nick. He took the baby and held him very carefully. Perhaps he was worried Conlon would explode.
Can this wait?
The female knight asked.
No,
Nick told her.
Better,
Conlon told him. Nick picked up a pretzel and offered it to my son. Conlon grabbed it and stuck it in his mouth. I pulled up a chair and sat down.
What is it? Nick asked.
Am I interrupting something important?
Yes.
Good. If you return my phone calls, I wouldn't have to hunt you down all over the city. A bit of professionalism, Nick, that's all I'm asking. He leaned forward.
Oh, professionalism.
Mm-hmm.
I'm supposed to offer a professional response to, call me, you stubborn dickhead.
Nick!
Earmuffs.
Nick clamped his hands over Conlon's ears.
Sorry.
You are a dickhead. You know I wouldn't call unless it was urgent. At least I knew he checked his messages. Conlon squirmed.
What is this about? Nick growled.
Someone cleared out Serenby. They went through, shot all of the dogs with sniper precision, rounded up approximately 200 people, boiled them to extract the bones, and dumped the remains by the old Walmart distribution center. The table suddenly went quiet. Nick dropped his hands from Conlon's ears.
When?
The disappearance was discovered last Sunday. I found out yesterday when we found the mass grave.
Who's on it?
Biohazard and Teddy Joe. One of his faithful died and is now in that sludge.
Is it Roland?
I shook my head. It didn't feel like him. Conlon must have decided that Nick needed cheering up because he took his soggy pretzel out of his mouth and tried to feed it to the night protector. Nick gently guided the pretzel away from his lips.
It was done with skill and precision. No survivors, almost no evidence. You think there will be a repeat performance?
It's a safe bet.
Okay,
he said.
Who's got it at Biohazard?
Luther. I called it in.
Something of this magnitude, he'll bring in the GBI. He'll probably go to Garcia. She owes me a favor. I'll call her to see if they'll bring us in on it.
It would help. I took Conlon from him. Say bye to Uncle Stupidhead. Conlon waved his hand.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, Nick waved back.
I got up to leave. Thank you for letting me interrupt your important lunch. You're not planning on taking off somewhere with your friends, are you?
No,
Nick said, his face made of stone.
Good, because the city needs you, and you don't have a costume, so sending bat signals with floodlights is right out.
I offered everyone a big smile.
There, all professional.
Mrs. Leonard,
the dark-skinned knight said,
I'm Knight of Better Norwood. I would like to visit you at a later date.
I glanced at Nick.
Who are the Holy Trinity?
They're from out of town,
he said. I shrugged. You're welcome to come by. Nick knows where to find me.
You seem ordinary,
the female knight said.
Good.
I could kill you right now, she stated. I rolled my eyes, turned, and walked out. I drove by Cutting Edge to check my messages. When I pulled into the parking lot, a courier was sitting on my doorstep. She was about 12, short, Latina, and armed with a shotgun. She stuffed a big yellow envelope with a biohazard stamp in the corner into my hands, had me sign the receipt, and took off on her bicycle without a word. The envelope contained several typed pages with the analysis and brief write-up of the scene at Serenby, and a 12-page list of names, one per line. The dead. I glanced through the report. They M-scanned the houses in Serenby, blue across the board. I brought Conlon in, checked my messages, which were non-existent, grabbed the case file Derek and I had put together yesterday, loaded Conlon back into the car seat, took my paperwork with me, and drove home. I could just as well work from the house, and at least at home I had toys and a familiar environment to back me up. 2.5 seconds after being put into the car seat, my son started screaming. We didn't even make it out of the parking lot. I got out and checked the car seat for hidden dangers. The seat was fine. Conlon was also fine, despite all of the squirming and pulling on the car seat belt. I offered him a sippy cup with juice, and he threw it on the floor. Oh, no. Is it tantrum time? It was definitely tantrum time, complete with wailing and real tears. I kissed him on the forehead. I love you. We have to go home. I can't hold you right now. But you're safe. Conlon shrieked. I got back into the driver's seat and headed home. I couldn't really complain. Conlon rarely cried, but once in a while he pitched a fit, usually because he was tired and didn't want to fall asleep. He was a baby, and babies threw tantrums because life was hard and not fair and their wishes were rarely taken into account. The real question was, how long would it take him to figure out how to unbuckle himself? That day was coming, and then we would be in real trouble. I missed Curran. I wanted him to come home. This whole thing was deeply disturbing, and it felt like a part of me had gone missing. I wanted him back, and I wanted us to all be together. About 15 minutes into the drive, Conlon gave up singing the sad song of his people and fell asleep. The Serenby nightmare bothered me. 200 people.
families, children. That wasn't just murder. It was an atrocity. I would have liked to think only something inhuman was capable of it. But the entire history of humanity proved me otherwise. All of the magic scans pointed to human magic. Was it some sort of massive human sacrifice? If it was, what the hell were they summoning it with? Whatever it was, I would find it and kill it, and then I would find the ones responsible and make them regret not dying with it. It took me roughly 30 minutes to get to our subdivision. Our house sat in the middle of a short, curved street, tucked into the crook of the forest, which my husband bought and named the 500-acre wood. Originally, it was the beginning of a new sprawling neighborhood, but the woods proved too aggressive. The development barely got off the ground before it was cut short. Then we moved in, which made all but two human families find quieter accommodations. Now, our street was mostly people who had separated with us from the pack. The other two streets were settled by shapeshifters who, for work reasons, decided to live in Atlanta. Even when Curran tried to distance himself, the pack still found him one way or another. I didn't complain. The place was a fortress without walls. And if I sneezed the wrong way, about 40 spree killers, armed with fangs, claws, and nasty dispositions, would come running. Even so, I'd sunk so much power into the perimeter wards that the entire College of Mages would have a tough time breaking through. I had this recurring nightmare of my father teleporting in and stealing my son. The driveway before our house was empty. Curran was still gone. Come on, honey. Time to come home. I tucked the file and the envelope under my arm and picked up Conlon. He was still sleepy and draped himself over my shoulder, all warm and limp. I unlocked the door, walked inside, and dropped the file off on the table. Here we are, I murmured to Conlon, hugging him to me gently. We're home. We're going to go upstairs and take a nice nap. Conlon jerked in my arms. What is it? My son yanked his head back, staring at the door, his eyes wide and terrified. The doorbell rang. Conlon made a low, rough noise. Alarm shot down my spine. Babies didn't make those noises. It's okay. My son rammed his forehead into my mouth. I tasted blood. He threw his entire weight back, tore out of my arms, landed on his feet, and ran for the stairs. What the bloody hell? I dashed after him in time to see his feet disappear into our bedroom on the third floor. He'd cleared the entire staircase in about a second. The lock clicked shut. Our bedroom door had a custom door handle that locked when closed. You had to push a switch on top of it to open it, something Conlon hadn't figured out yet. Okay, door first, son later. I wiped my mouth with the back of my hand, pulled Surratt out, and slid the small viewing window open. Grass, a maple tree, and driveway. No fire-spitting monsters, no vicious killers. The tech was up. I listened. Quiet. Yeah. There was probably a terrestrial man-eating octopus crouching on the wall just above the door waiting to pounce. It had been a long time since we'd had fried calamari. Technically, calamari was squid and not octopus, but as long as I fried it, who cared about the details? I didn't have time to mess around. I needed to get this sorted and figure out why my son was freaking out. I swung the door open. The front lawn was empty. A wooden box waited in front of the door, about 2 feet long, 1 foot wide, and maybe 8 inches deep. Plain, untreated wood, probably pine. 2 metal hinges on the left side. Someone had waited until I came home, then dropped it off on my doorstep. They were in our neighborhood, watching our house, and I didn't notice when I came home because I was a moron. I'd gotten comfortable in the past 18 months. Sloppy, Voron's voice said from my memories. Yeah, I know. I stepped outside, carefully padded past the box, and jogged to the end of the driveway. The street was deserted in both directions. I didn't feel anyone watching me. Whoever had delivered it had come and gone. Didn't bother to stick around to see if I got it. I turned back. The box looked perfectly harmless.
Right,
and as soon as I touched it, it would sprout whirring metal blades and carve me to pieces. I crouched and poked the box with Surratt. The box didn't seem impressed. Poke. Poke, poke. Shove. Nothing. Fine. I slid the tip of my blade between the lid and the box and flipped it open. A thick layer of ash filled the box. On it lay a knife and a red rose. And that wasn't freaky, not at all. The knife was about 20 inches overall, with a 14-inch blade sharpened all the way on the left into a half point on the right side. Plain wooden handle, no guard. Simple, efficient, brutal. Reminded me of a skean, an Irish battle knife. The rose was burgundy red, the color of Merlot, or blood. Long thorns. I sheathed my saber and picked up the box. It smelled faintly of fire. Not sulfur or smoke, but that particular heated scent when the wood got very hot just before it was about to burst into flames. There was something else, too. The hint of a darker and sharper odor I couldn't quite place. I took the flower out, picked up the knife, and shifted the ash with the blade. Nothing hidden in the ashes. Was this some sort of threat? Whatever it was, it seemed inert enough for the time being. I'd have to deal with it after I found my son. I went into the garage, got a plastic bin, put the knife and the rose back into the box, placed the box into the bin, and carried it to the shed in the back. The shed served as my depository of weird crap I didn't want to bring into the house. I set the plastic bin in a salt circle on the floor, locked the shed, ran back inside, washed my hands, and bounded up the stairs, two steps at a time. It was quiet. Way too quiet for comfort. I unlocked the door, stepped inside, and locked it behind me. From my vantage point, I could see through the arched entrance to the small nursery area Kern had sectioned off from our room. Conlon's crib was empty, his blanket hanging halfway over the wooden rail. The bathroom door on my left remained shut, secured by a small latch bar only an adult could reach. That was the only way to keep Conlon out of the bathroom. He kept trying to eat soap and then cried when he realized it didn't taste delicious. The only good hiding place was under the bed. Curran liked to sleep high, and our bed was a massive beast that rose a full 18 inches off the floor, not counting the box spring and mattress. Plenty of space. Conlon, I called. Where is my boy? Silence. I moved forward on my toes. Curran and I played hide-and-seek with him all the time. Usually one of us would grab him and hide while the other one counted. Conlon was ridiculously easy to find because he cracked up when you got close. To stay quiet wasn't in his nature. A step toward the bed. Where is Conlon? I sank right into the rhythm of the game. Is he in the corner? No, he isn't. Another step. Is he in his crib? No, he isn't. Another step. Is he under the bed? A clawed paw shot out from under the bed and swiped at my leg. I jumped a foot in the air and 3 feet back. It couldn't be. I dropped down on the floor. A pair of glowing gray eyes stared at me from under the bed. Gold light rolled over them. The telltale shapeshifter fire. I'd seen that gold glow just 5 days ago, when our idiot poodle tried to throw up by Kern's chair. Conlon? A low, growling noise answered me. Oh, crap. Crap, crap, crap. He'd shifted. He'd turned into a baby lion. Oh, my God. I stared at the eyes. Maybe I was imagining it.
Conlin?
Row, 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 row.
Nope, not imagining it. He'd shifted. I reached out, and Conlin scooted back deeper under the bed. Crap.
Conlin, come out.
Roar, roar.
The phone rang. Maybe it was Curran. I grabbed it.
Kate Leonard.
Hello. A saccharine male voice chirped. I'm calling from Sunshine Realty. Are you interested in selling your home?
No.
I hung up and dropped down again.
Roar, roar.
Conlin Dillman Leonard, do not growl at me again. Come out from under the bed. He backed farther into the darkness, squeezing himself against the far wall. The bed weighed a ton. I could probably heave an edge of it up for a few seconds, but that was it. A fat lot of good that would do me. I could get a broom and poke him with it. It would be long enough. But then that might just panic him more. Maybe if I sat on the floor and waited? The doorbell rang. It was the delivery boy back. Surratt and I could give him a piece of my mind. I jumped to my feet, walked over to the window, and carefully edged the curtain aside just enough to see. A pack jeep sat in the driveway. Don't go anywhere, I told Conlin. The doorbell rang again. I left the bedroom, shut the door, ran downstairs, and jerked the door open. Andrea grinned at me. I finally got away. Laura called me Andrea the Merciless to my face. Can you believe that, bitch? Wait until I tell you what she did. I should have given her a mouth of rock hauling. We can have lunch. I grabbed her and pulled her inside.
Okay,
she said. Hello to you too, sweet cheeks. I need you to help me catch my kid. A one-year-old gave you the slip? Oh, how the mighty have fallen. He's hiding under the bed. I need you to help me get him out. Why did you let him crawl into the bed? Shut up and come with me. I dragged her up the stairs. Okay, okay. I unlocked the bedroom door and dropped by the bed. Andrea dropped flat next to me. What am I looking at? Two shining gold eyes stared back at us. She opened her mouth. It stayed open. Conlin backed into the wall again. Andrea sat up and pointed under the bed. Her blue eyes opened as wide as they could go. Yes, I told her.
When?
She squeaked. Just now. What does he look like?
I don't know. You can see for yourself once we get him out from under the bed.
We both looked under the bed again. Okay, Andrea said. Okay, he's shifted, so he should be hungry. Do you have meat? All the meat is frozen. What's wrong with you? She demanded. Curran is off on one of his hunting trips. It's just me and Conlin. I've been eating salami sandwiches and ramen for the last 3 days. Why would you do this to yourself?
Because it's easy.
What do you feed him? She pointed under the bed.
Chicken, oatmeal, apples, vegetables.
Andrea stared at me. Do I even know you? What do you have for a treat?
Cookies.
Your son is a lion.
I know that.
Cookies aren't going to cut it. Do you know any lion hunters who bait their traps with cookies? I don't know any lion hunters, period. And you know what? Apple pie works for me. I've got news for you. It wasn't your apple pie Curran was interested in.
She had me there.
Do you have any salami left?
No.
Andrea growled. Go get the cookies. 1 minute later, we sat on the bed, staring at a plate on the floor with two chocolate chip cookies and a small puddle of honey. I don't think you understand the whole predatory cat thing, Andrea informed me. He likes honey. We sat in silence. This isn't working, I growled. Her eyes sparkled. You should try calling. Here, kitty, 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 kitty. I will kill you and nobody will find your body. She chuckled. Another minute. Sounds of muffled chewing came from under the bed. He's eating something. What could he be chewing under there? Andrea frowned. Electric cords, old tissues, dead bugs. Kate Leonard, Mother of the Year. What do you feed your son? Dead bugs he found under the bed, of course. I jumped off the bed.
We need to get him out now.
Andrea rolled her eyes.
Have I told you that you're a helicopter parent?
I'm going to be the wrath of hell parent in a minute.
I crouched by the bed.
You lift, I grab.
Okay.
Andrea gripped the edge of the massive bed and jerked it up like it weighed nothing.
A black lion cub the size of a small chow chow darted toward her.
I lunged for him and missed. He snarled and locked his teeth on Andrea's shin.
Ow! Don't drop the bed on my kid!
I grabbed Conlon by the scruff of his neck and yanked him back.
Get him off my leg!
Andrea howled. I slid my arm under Conlon's furry throat and squeezed, sinking steel into my voice.
Let go. Let go right now.
Andrea snarled, and the noise that came from her throat was pure hyena. I squeezed harder, applying a chokehold. Conlon released the bite and gasped. I rolled out of the way, moving my son so I landed on top of him, and Andrea dropped the bed. The floor shuddered. A red stain spread through her jeans.
Your son bit me.
Sorry.
Conlon bucked under me. I held tight.
He bit me.
She pointed at her leg.
He can't help it. You smell like a hyena and you're scary.
I'm not scary. I'm nice. I've babysat him like 20 times. I gave him ice cream. Ungrateful brat. The brat gave up on trying to throw me off and went flat on the floor. I got up. Conlon shook himself. He looked just like a lion cub. His fur was black and velvety soft with faint smoky stripes, and his ears were round and fluffy. He blinked at me and twitched his ears. I cracked up.
He's adorable, Andrea said. I'm still pissed off, but he is so fluffy. Baby Bee used to be that fluffy.
Roar, roar,
Conlon told her. I reached out and popped him on the nose with my fingers.
No.
He recoiled like a chastised kitten and blinked.
You bit Aunt Andrea. We don't bite our friends.
Colin noticed the plate and wandered over to it. A pink tongue slid out of his mouth. He licked the honey.
Now I've seen everything, Andrea said.
She hiked her jeans leg up and showed me a red wound on her shin.
I felt his teeth scrape bone. He's got a hell of a bite.
That's a lion right there.
Sorry.
Oh, you're going to have to do better than sorry. Your son assaulted the alpha of Clan Bauda.
She wrinkled her nose at me.
It's already closing, you big baby.
It will close better if you buy me a late lunch and some margaritas.
Conlon licked the plate clean, crawled into my lap, and draped himself over me.
He had to be at least 35 pounds, probably closer to 40.
Lunch might have to wait.
I'll tell you what. Give me a crash course in shapeshifter toddlers, and I'll give you some of our homemade sangria.
The sangria started as an experiment. Before the 500-acre wood formed, someone in the area must have grown grapes in their backyard, because we came across a clearing with several old vines. Christopher mentioned that he grew up on a vineyard in California. I asked him to teach me how to make wine. One thing led to another, and now I made forest sangria. I had also planted some of the vines in the backyard, but they were too young to produce fruit.
Andrea's eyes lit up. Did you make a new batch?
I did.
Deal. Usually, they shift at birth, and then about once or twice a week, so you get a chance to get used to it. But your boy never turned before, so your mileage may vary.
My mileage always varied.
How long does it last? He'll shift back when there is something he needs hands for, or when he gets tired. Same rules as an adult shapeshifter. One shift, maybe two per 24 hours, and after that second, he'll need a nap. The babies don't know their limits yet, so be prepared for him to try two shifts in a row and flop right on his face. It's kind of funny. They just go boop and fall over.
The last time he fell over and got a knot on his forehead, I drove him to Doolittle like a bat out of hell. Andrea sat next to me.
Cheer up. Babies are easy. It's the adolescents who make problems. Before you know it, he'll be a teenager, and Curran will start teaching him half form.
Stop.
The worst is over.
He's well-formed, he's proportionate, no weird bones sticking out anywhere.
I mean it! Stop!
Okay, okay. So what else? Oh, he will have a bit of a learning curve, figuring out what he can do in each shape. Some things are instinctive, like if he is chasing something, he may shift without thinking. But a lot of times they'll try to bite things while in human form or change shape and want their sippy cup. Baby Bee carried her spoon around in her mouth when she turned into a hyena. It was the funniest thing. I'd cut up meat for her, and she still wanted me to put it on the spoon and feed her.
Wait until I tell Raphael.
I wish you wouldn't.
What?
Why?
Because your husband gossips like a church lady.
Please don't insult me. Church ladies line up around the block to take gossip lessons from Raphael.
Andrea grinned.
No, seriously, why?
Because if you tell Raphael, the entire pack will run over here to gawk at him, and I can't do this right now. I have shit to deal with.
Is it Roland?
No.
I told her about Serenby.
Well, fuck, she said.
Yep.
We sat quietly for a while. Conlon was sprawled on my lap, making a low rumbling noise. It was almost like purring. It felt oddly comforting.
If you had to shoot a dog in the eye with an arrow from a regular bow, what's the longest distance you could do it from? I asked.
Regular bow? I could guarantee a shot at 45 yards. If it was a highly trained archer who wasn't me, maybe 30? But an eye is a small target and dogs like to move.
Andrea sighed.
It can never just be peaceful, can it?
Oh, I don't know. The past 18 months were pretty quiet.
She snorted.
What about the Cherufe burning down City Hall 2 months ago?
It only scorched City Hall.
And before that, there was the Raiju thing. And before that,
I held up my hand.
Okay, yes. But you know what I mean. All these were normal. This thing in Serenby isn't normal. This is magic on a massive scale,
Andrea sighed.
As if on cue, a magic wave rolled over us. Conlon raised his head, shook himself, and lay back down on my lap.
I need Curran to come back, I told her. He was a baby lion before. It would really help.
What is up with your lion anyway? This is what, his third one?
Fourth.
Curran once explained to me in excruciating detail how he hated to hunt. According to him, he was a lion. He weighed over 600 pounds, and the last thing he wanted to do was run through the woods chasing after deer. But since Conlon's birth, he and Era had hatched a plan to extend the guild's reach past Atlanta for a strategic advantage when my father eventually came calling. Usually this strategic outreach involved hunting some sort of monster on the outskirts of Atlanta. It took Curran 3 or 4 days to catch it, and my aunt insisted on going with him.
He takes Era with him. That's the most puzzling part.
Maybe they're bonding?
My aunt, who continuously reminds me that I married a barbaric animal, and my husband, who thinks she's an insane murderous bitch, are bonding?
Stranger things have happened.
Andrea reached out and petted Conlon's head. He sniffed her hand.
You remember Andrea, I murmured.
Of course he does. He was just a little scared. Changing is confusing.
So what triggered it?
I looked at her.
Baby shapeshifters turn because they get scared. That's why a lot of them shift at birth. Leaving the womb is scary. He didn't turn even when Doolittle terrified him. There had to be some sort of severe threat. What were you doing when he shifted?
The box. That had to be the thing.
I was answering the door. Someone left a present for me on my doorstep.
Was it a nice present?
No.
I got up.
I'll show you, but I think we'd better leave him here.
We locked Conlon in the bedroom and went downstairs. I got out 2 bottles of sangria and poured Andrea a glass. She tasted the wine.
I can't understand why you don't drink this stuff.
Because at some point in my life I was a borderline alcoholic.
Why do you drink it? You can't even get a buzz.
Because it's delicious.
Andrea pulled one of the bottles to her and refilled the glass. I left her in the kitchen to get the box. It still sat where I'd left it. I picked it up and walked back to the house.